Fairy side,
by thy side we'll stand and always praise thy name.
Praise thy name, praise thy name
to heaven.
Yeah.
Lend our hearts and hands to help increase thy faith.
Ooh,
the honor,
yeah,
of all this I have brings forth our loyalty.
Loyalty, loyalty.
So cheer for dear old Eastside High. Lead on to victory.
Welcome to Sup Media Reviews, the podcast that never needs spoiler alerts because it takes you back in time to relive the nostalgia of classic TV shows and films that you've probably already seen. I'm your host, Kiara, and each week I'll dive into the archives to bring you my take on movies and TV shows from at least 20 years ago. From cult classics to forgotten gems, I'll review them all and give my honest opinion on their impact and whether or not they still hold up today. Join me as we revisit the iconic characters, memorable moments, and timeless themes that made these shows and films so special. So take a break from adulting and get ready for a trip down memory lane with Sup Media Reviews.
What's up, Home Slices? Thanks so much for tuning into Sup Media Reviews. I'm your host, Kiara, and before we get started today, I want to say how happy I am that Sup Media Reviews celebrated its 1 year anniversary on May 2nd. I cannot believe I've been doing this for a year, and I'm so excited to continue this journey with you all. I want to say a special thanks to all the listeners, followers, subscribers, and special guests that have made this past year a delight. We have some new things coming up this year, so make sure you stay connected on YouTube, Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Today, I'm stoked to review the iconic 1989 film Lean On Me, featuring Morgan Freeman as Principal Joe Clark, Beverly Todd as Miss Levias, Jermaine Hopkins as Thomas Sams, and Karen Melina White as Kenesha Carter. This movie is based on the real-life controversial educator Joe Clark. This week is also Teachers Appreciation Week, so I figured that we could focus on educators, teaching, and schools this week. Make sure that you are appreciating the educators out there in the world that are doing a really hard job for not a lot of money. So let's make sure that we uplift those folks on this week. Now, this movie is a classic in the Black community, and I haven't seen it in a while, so I'm excited to rewatch it with you. Here are a few fun facts about the movie. The real life Joe Clark resigned as principal of Eastside High, shortly after the film was released. Around the time the film debuted, he was suspended by the school board for 1 week after scheduling an assembly in which dancers stripped down to their G-strings. Clark said that he hadn't known about it in advance. Now, ironically, the man who suspended him was Dr. Frank Napier, and we'll get to him as we go throughout the movie. Now, after Clark left Eastside, he became an author and motivational speaker. In 1995, he was hired to run a juvenile detention center in Newark, New Jersey, a position that he held until he resigned in 2002. During his time there, he once again came under fire for his controversial methods. So controversy basically follows this man everywhere that he goes. He has a radical approach to dealing with youth and education. So yeah, that makes him ripe to have his story written down in history as, you know, this film. Now, in a second fun fact, according to a March 3rd, 1989 LA Times article, high school principal Joe Clark's life story rights were optioned by Universal Pictures in 1984, but the project was stalled. In 1986, Warner Brothers and producer Norman Twain took over the rights, paying Clark $15,000 and a small percentage of the film's gross. Sidney Poitier was Warner Brothers' first choice for the role of Joe Clark, but the actor turned it down because he did not agree with Clark's politics. Bill Cosby was approached next, but filmmakers determined that the performer's low energy was too low. So Eddie Murphy was considered. However, Murphy's contract with Paramount Pictures barred him from appearing in any Warner Brothers production. Danny Glover was also named as a contender, but the actor was expected to star in the upcoming Warner Brothers Lethal Weapon sequel, so he couldn't do it. Morgan Freeman, who had recently won an Obie Award for his off-Broadway performance in Driving Miss Daisy, was cast after the others were ruled out, although producer Twain insisted that Freeman was always his first choice. Now, in preparation for this role, Freeman shadowed Clark for several weeks at Eastside High School in Paterson, New Jersey, where the film was also shot. This role is Morgan Freeman's first lead role in a theatrical feature film. Eastside students and high school students from the neighboring New Jersey and New York schools portray most of the teens in the film, with lead roles going to first-time actors discovered at open auditions. Now, one of these people who auditioned that, you know, were brought into the limelight through this film was Karen Melina White, and this movie is her film debut. You may know her from The Cosby Show and A Different World as Charmaine. She's also the voice of Dejanay from The Proud Family. Sticky! Or you might know her from portraying Nicolette in Malcolm and Eddie. So this movie has a number of stars in it. And speaking of stars, in the auditorium scene, when Morgan Freeman's character expels some students on stage, a young Michael Imperioli is visible behind him. In that same scene, a young Taye Diggs can be seen sitting in the audience. He is wearing a blue shirt. So this movie has a number of stars sprinkled throughout, even if they just have little cameos. So that's pretty cool. If you want to check out Lean On Me, unfortunately, you'll have to rent it as of the recording of this episode. As always, whenever I rent a film, I use Amazon Prime as they have the helpful IMDb X-ray feature. Again, I don't have any sponsors for this podcast yet, but I've been plugging the IMDb feature for Amazon for a minute, so we're gonna put that into the atmosphere for future reference. So this is the part where we talk about my personal connection to the film. Now, the first time I ever saw this film, I was a senior in high school, and my sociology / psychology teacher showed us the film in class. Now, I don't know that I recognized it as the Black film gem that it is. In the Black community, this movie is quoted often and has a number of stars in it that we love, right? Joe Clark in this movie is pretty famous for his platitudes and the cadence of his voice, and that makes for some very iconic and even hilarious scenes. My favorite quotes include, "She used to call me Crazy Joe, but now she called me Batman," or "I don't have to do nothing but stay Black and die." Like, those are things that you will just randomly hear around the Black community, and they are hilarious, okay? We also get some singing, right? Like, the Eastside High School song is pretty iconic, and I know all the words just from watching this movie and hearing other people sing it as well. So it's kind of fantastic that the legacy of this movie lives on in multiple forms, right? Like, we got quotes, we have the Morgan Freeman, we have the Fair Eastside High song. This movie is very iconic in the Black community. Also, Joe Clark has like a radical and controversial approach to dealing with youth, both in real life and in the movie. And so it's interesting that I have to rewatch the movie to say that this movie allows space for people to both love and hate Joe Clark. That's really what I'm trying to get out, is that at times you don't know if he is like being antagonistic or if he's just being radical and like is years ahead of his time. There's a lot of space to both love and hate this character, and Morgan Freeman does a really good job at playing this character, and his portrayal of Joe Clark laid a base for Freeman's illustrious career as a lead actor, because this was the first time that he was cast in a lead role. And so people love, you know, Morgan Freeman so much, and it's interesting to see that his like lead actor movie career got started with this film, right? So that's kind of cool. Now, I'm excited to share my perspective on this movie, but before I do, I want to let you all know that I am experimenting with this review. Now, typically when I review a film, I take notes as I watch it, and this takes a long time because I'm literally transcribing the notes during the movie and have to pause frequently, making a 1.5 hour movie take about 3 hours to watch. Then I spend another 1.5 hours recording the review, and it's pretty time intensive. So I'm doing something different this time. I am going to watch the movie, pause pause it, record some commentary scene by scene, and do that over and over again till we get through the end of the movie. I'm also going to minimize editing this time and try to provide a more raw, immediate reaction to what's happening in the film. So I'm hoping that you all will listen to the review and let me know if you like this format. Let's go ahead and dive into Lean On Me. So y'all, we open the film with the Eastside High song being sung in the background, and there's some text on the screen that talks about how Eastside High was a great school and declined greatly over time. They start the movie with showing Eastside High in 1967 with a young Morgan Freeman, who is playing Joe Clark, in a dashiki with his afro, teaching history to an all-white class in a really engaging way. It's like a game show with like girls versus boys. Now, he openly talks about racism with the students and how it is a stain on the soul of America, which is very interesting because there are a lot of people who don't want race or anything race related to be taught in schools for whatever reason. So to see that he was doing this back in the late 60s is pretty cool. So a black man named Frank Napier, interrupts him during the class to say that the union that they had formed together with some other teachers is meeting without him and Joe. Joe, of course, is mad about this. And Joe is like a fast talker. Again, talks in a lot of platitudes. He's very, it's funny to me. It's like, he's very loquacious. He's very elegant. And when he gets angry, he does it in a way that's just so fluid and well-spoken that it's just hilarious to me. I don't know. I've never heard the actual Joe Clark speak. I haven't seen any interviews or anything, but this element of this character is hilarious to me. Frank, of course, is trying to calm Joe down, but he kind of isn't having it. So he enters the room and crashes the party where the union executive board is meeting, and he chastises them for not having any courage when it comes to standing up to the Board of Education. Apparently, Joe was like leading the fight for them to like be able to choose their own curriculum and do things their own way. But the Board of Education, of course, has some strings that they can pull to get the teachers to kind of do what they want to do. And the other teachers are tired of the fight, right? Like the other teachers find Joe to be too radical and that he causes too much agitation, and all these teachers want to do is be able to pay their bills. And so the kind of leader, I'm guessing, of the executive board tells Joe that the Board of Education is going to grant them their salary increases if they agree to Joe being transferred to another school. So they actually kind of sold Joe up the river, as they used to say. So Joe puts a dollar bill on the forehead of one of the board members and leaves, saying that this school deserves exactly what it gets. So he leaves Eastside High in a huff, and he's being treated like a Judas. So we see a time lapse of the same school. It's now 20 years later. The school is in disrepair. There's graffiti everywhere, and there's like a big lack of care for the school. I didn't mean for all of that to rhyme. Disrepair, graffiti everywhere, lack of care. That's how you describe Eastside High at this point. So now it is 1987. Now, the school is actually predominantly black, which is interesting because 20 years ago, it was a predominantly white school, or at least the class that Joe was teaching was all white students. So there's been a change in the neighborhood apparently as well. And so y'all, when I tell y'all, this is probably the scariest school that I have ever seen in the history of my life. It is so scary, y'all. There are kids fighting in the hallways. There are kids throwing toilets out of windows. Even the girls are vicious, and they strip another girl's shirt off of her, and she has to like run out into the hallway and be covered up by a teacher. A man comes to the front door of the school, and a student allows him to bring drugs into the school to be sold to the students. The cafeteria is loud and crowded. The teachers don't get any respect, and one of the teachers is even assaulted and is wheeled out of an ambulance with a bloody head. There are kids buying drugs and guns. There's cage-like structures all over the cafeteria. Y'all, when I saw that teacher get hurt, like, my heart dropped. I literally cannot imagine being in a school like that, y'all. I went to a high school that had some problems, like little things was happening here and there, but to every day have to go to the same place and to be subjected with violence and drugs and you go to school to get educated and you're not learning anything because of how scary the environment is and how the teachers have lost control over what's happening with the students. That is just so scary to me. And I really can't imagine being in that type of learning environment. We see a chunky young man who we later learn is Thomas Sams, and he gets stuffed into a locker and he's yelling for his life for someone to let him out. And a young Kenesha tries to get help for him. Kenesha comes up a lot in this story. This is Karen Melina White's character. She tries to get help for him, but no one seems to care. So there are a few students that we kind of highlight and focus on, and Thomas and Kenesha are actually two of them, and we'll talk more about them later. Now, next up, we see a politician named Don talking with a couple of his advisors about some of the things that are coming up for him, right? So long story short, Don is the mayor and he's up for re-election, and the state passed some legislation that will allow them to take over schools if at least 75% of the students don't pass a basic skills test. So I don't actually know what it means for a state to take over a school. Does it mean they shut it down? I don't really know. But apparently it just doesn't look good, right? Like, to have a school that is performing so poorly and to have the state come in. So I am not totally aware of what the ramifications of that are, but it will look bad for Don, the mayor, to have that happen on his watch, particularly during a re-election year. So at Eastside High, we learn that Frank Napier, the same Frank from earlier in the story, is now the superintendent of schools, and Eastside has a passing rate of 38% compared to the 75% that the school needs to have to keep the state off their backs. So essentially half of what they need it to be. Now, the other advisor that's in the room with the mayor is a lawyer named Rosenberg. They need a person who can turn the school around, and Frank has only one guy in mind, and we all know it's Joe Clark, y'all. So Don obviously relents because this is a job that nobody is going to want to take, right? With the amount of crazy stuff that's going on at that school, you have to be strong and resilient and fantastic to not just die walking into the school. So they need somebody who has nothing to lose, is the way that they put it. So Frank and Rosenberg visit Joe at an elementary school where he's working. And Frank tells Joe, you know, this is an opportunity for us to make a difference. And Joe is like, I'm calling BS. You all only want me because nobody else wants to take the job. And both the mayor and Frank are trying to save their own butts. Frank tells Joe, you know what the real truth is? You want to know the real truth? Is that neither you nor I have made a real difference in the world. Now, how about you sleep on that? Okay. And for whatever reason, that works on Joe. I think Joe working at an elementary school, maybe feeling like he isn't making a large difference in the world, and feeling like, you know, maybe he is the only person for the job, I guess is what inspired him to take the job at Eastside High. Because in the next scene, Joe is walking the halls of the school that he worked at 20 years ago. And you can see the shock on his face that, you know, this school is not what it used to be 20 years ago when it was a predominantly white school and he was teaching there. So in this next scene, Joe meets with the teachers who are excited to have him, but Joe starts right away laying down the law. He basically tells all the teachers in the room to shut up. Nobody speaks in the meetings, and that he wants a list of all the hoodlums and miscreants in the school. He wants the janitor to get all the graffiti scrubbed off the wall in a timely manner and to use the detention students as free child labor to, you know, work to those ends. He says he wants the cages torn down at the cafeteria because if you treat the kids like animals, that's how they'll act. He also introduces his new dean of security, Mr. William Wright, who's played by Tony Todd, AKA Candyman. That's crazy, y'all. Joe demands discipline and accountability from the teachers. He assigns roles, like reassigns some roles between the teachers as well, and says, you know, you all have been doing it your way and you have been failing our students. They can barely read. They got a 38% pass rate on that basic skills test. Like, what are y'all doing? So now that you all know that you have failed, basically, we're going to do it my way. Okay. And he basically won't stand for anyone being in opposition of what it means to do it his way. He has less than one school year to get the school turned around so that the state doesn't take it over. So I believe we're in October in this month at this point in the story. So Joe calls himself the HNIC, which stands for Head Negro in Charge. I did the kind of PC version of that. But Joe is already laying down the law. And so the teachers are kind of taken aback by it. But you all, how much responsibility do those teachers have? They haven't had a united front. They probably haven't had like a good, strong leader, and they don't get any respect. One of them was just wheeled out of there in an ambulance. The teachers are scared for their own lives, and teachers don't get paid enough to endure what they endure today, but they definitely weren't getting paid enough in 1987 to endure what they were enduring at Eastside High, y'all. So more power to these teachers, y'all. So in this next scene, there's a school assembly and a select group of students are asked to go on the stage while the rest of the students sit in the audience. Y'all, the students are all over the place. The kids on stage are performing rap songs and just acting a fool. The kids in the audience are smoking and causing a ruckus. It's just so loud in there. And so some of the teachers are going around finding different students and asking them to go on the stage. So Joe comes into the auditorium and Kanisha spots him. Apparently he was her elementary school principal and he offers his assistance to her anytime that she needs it. So he cares about this student in particular. Now Joe takes to the stage and asks everyone to quiet down. They do eventually, but it takes a minute for things to get real quiet. He introduces himself and as the new principal, and he demands that there is no more smoking in this school. And he's like, everybody in the audience, put out them cigarettes right now. So he's again already laying down the law. He asked the kids on the stage to sing the school song, and of course they are not with it. One of the teachers starts to play the school song on the piano, and one of the kids even tells actually it's Thomas Sams who tells Joe Clark to suck his you know what. And so the kids on the stage aren't participating, they aren't with it. So Joe tells the piano player to cut it out, and Joe takes a look at all the fools on the stage and he says, y'all look at them, okay? They've taken up space for up to 5 years and they haven't done anything with it. Okay. They've been disruptive. They've harassed the teachers. They've harassed you all in the audience. They sold drugs and guns. They have made the school hell on earth, basically. And he's like, these kids on the stage who basically had no chance of graduating anyway are being expurgated. Fancy word. But basically he's expelling them. And the security officer has like a bunch of other security guards with him, and a lot of the students are like transported out by security. Thomas Sams is actually one of the kids that gets expelled. So the drug dealer that we saw earlier in the movie actually threatens Joe, saying like Joe is going to get him. He said something also about him wanting to go into the Air Force, and I guess being expelled from high school does not bode well for someone who wants to go into the military. So that drug dealer is quite angry. Now Joe says that the remaining students in the auditorium shouldn't be bothered with the riffraff of these miscreants in a learning institution. And a couple of things come to mind for me. The first one is that getting rid of like the bad apples seems like a good idea and a way to like at least cut out on probably half the crazy stuff that's going on in the school. Also numbers wise, it's a great way to get your numbers up, because if you expel the students who wouldn't pass anyway, then the percentage of kids who pass that basic skills test is going to go up. So, excellent strategy, I guess. Joe tells the kids in the audience, it could be any one of you all. Okay. Like if y'all want to cut up, y'all can go home too forever. Joe says that he wants the kids to be ghosts to bring glory back to the school, to like rise again and resurrect the glory of Eastside High to, I guess, what it used to be. He gives this kind of rousing speech to the kids. The kids are completely silent. They haven't experienced anything like this before. And basically, he wants the kids to be accountable for their future and for their actions. He says that they have 2 weeks until the practice test, that basic skills test, and 110 days until the real test on April 13th. So he really does not have a long time to get these kids in shape for this test before the state takes over the school. The auditorium again is like you could hear a pin drop, and he speaks with authority and he comes across well-meaning at this stage in the game. So he welcomes the students to the new Eastside High, and both the students and the teachers get to experience what it's like to not go to school and be super worried that you're gonna die or be sold drugs or you're gonna watch somebody else die, like, or be assaulted. So it's interesting. So far, not super radical, I guess, but a certain percentage of the student body being expelled at one time, maybe that is kind of radical. Anyways, next up we see a parent assembly with Joe Clark and tons of parents who are upset that they have to deal with their own delinquent students instead of the school dealing with them for 8 hours. There's one female parent that's specifically vocal about Joe's methods on his first day, saying that, you know, these students being expelled means they absolutely have no hope. They're just a little bit down about the economy and the state of the world and what they have to look forward to or what they don't have to look forward to, kind of creating excuses for these students. Now, Joe responds with another kind of rousing speech. Again, he's very eloquent, very convincing, and can turn on the charm when he wants to. But Joe responds saying that 300 bad apples in the school spoils the whole bunch. And there were not 300 kids up on that stage, but apparently he expelled 300 kids so that the remaining 2,700 could have a chance. That's 10% of the school that he expelled. So yeah, that's, first off, I've never seen a high school that big. I don't know where you all grew up. You know what? The high school that I ended up graduating from might have actually had somewhere around 2,000 students. So maybe it's not that big. I don't know. Anyways, Joe tells the parents that if they want their kids to succeed, they like need to get off welfare. They need to make their kids study, give the kids some pride and help them set their priorities. And some of the parents are cheering and other parents are upset and booing. It's really mixed reviews, which I like because when you have a figure like Joe Clark, he can be quite polarizing. And so some people will agree with his methods, some people won't. Some people will agree with certain things he does and other things that he doesn't. So I like in this story that we are showing that there are people who are on board and not on board with what Joe has going on, right? So Joe starts to do this kind of sermon saying that he feels called by God to turn the school around by any means necessary. He even uses the word transmogrify, which probably means the same as a transformation. But he basically wins over most of the crowd, but some of the parents are still upset. So in the next scene, it is the next day, early in the morning. Apparently he gets to the school at like 6 o'clock in the morning every day. And so Thomas Sams is on the front steps of the school saying that he was one of the kids that was expelled yesterday and it must have been a mistake. So when Joe looks at Thomas's file and sees that like Thomas doesn't go to class and that he smokes crack, he's like, nah, I didn't make a mistake. And so Thomas denies his wrongdoing and he's like, no, I don't smoke, you know, that wasn't me. And so Joe calls him out to the point where he takes Thomas on the roof and tells him that Thomas knows nothing because he's a teenager and he won't listen to anybody because he thinks he knows more than what adults know, which is, you know, the classic conundrum of all teenagers, right? I fell very victim to that. But Thomas starts to beg and cry to come back to the school saying that he can't tell his mom that he got expelled. And he's like, I'm going to do my work. I'm going to turn things around. I'm going to stay out of trouble. And Joe continues to challenge him more and tell Sams, go ahead and jump off the roof. And Sam's like, no, I don't want to do that. And of course, Joe says, you smoke crack, don't you? And finally, Sam says, yes, he admits to his wrongdoing. Accountability is a really big deal with Joe Clark, and I completely get it, right? So Joe tells Sams that, like, if you're smoking crack, you're dying a slow death. It's killing your brain cells. It's going to take years for you to expire. But if you want to kill yourself, you need to do it expeditiously. Now jump off the roof. And Sams is like, no, no. And he's begging and he's crying. And Joe finally relents, saying that if Sam messes up just once, that he's going to be out of the school for real. And so Joe had some mercy on this particular student. This particular student also had the wherewithal to come back and, like, beg to return. So shout out to both of them for making things happen. So it's a normal school day. We're in the cafeteria. Joe is interacting with the kids. He's learning their names. He even writes a pass for a young lady to switch from home ec to auto shop, which is like a non-gender conforming thing. And feels a little bit surprising that he would do something like that back in the late 80s. It's actually pretty cool. So yeah, he's getting to know the students, right? He's gaining some credibility with them. He's snitching on boys who holler at too many girls. He's, you know, chatting it up with the new class president, Richard, and he even catches Sam stealing some meatballs. And since Sam's is his, you know, pet project, and that he's going to be on top of him all the time to make sure he stays on the right track, Joe decides to embarrass Sam's and uses this, megaphone that he carries with him all the time so that everybody can hear them, to say that, you know, Sam's is a poor example of how you should dress. He calls the boys slovenly, and he says that the kids should learn how to dress with pride. I don't care for the whole embarrassing people situation, but Joe has no problem with it. Now, Sam's and his older senior friends, one of which is his cousin, are told to stand up and sing the school song together while everyone else is quiet and still. He demands that nobody talks or moves. Now, the boys don't really know the song, and they end up getting 3 days detention because of it. They also don't sound good singing together. Sounds pretty bad. But even a teacher who, his name is Mr. Darnell, but he is played by Michael Beach in this movie, is sent to the principal's office for moving when the boys are singing or attempting to sing the school song. So nobody is exempt from Joe's wrath. Even teachers will get embarrassed, okay, and chastised. Now, Joe demands that everyone will sing the school song on demand or be punished. So this is a sticking point for him. I guess it's about showing pride in the school, I suppose. Now, next up, Joe rushes into a choir class to tell the choir teacher to make sure all the students learn the school song. Now, the choir teacher kind of goes on with her lesson, and she's like, yeah, Joe, like, so Joe asks her to step outside of the classroom, and they get into this conversation where they have a power struggle, right? Like, the choir teacher is very strong and a little bit stubborn and insubordinate, particularly by Joe's standards. She calls him a bully, and she insults his intelligence. So Joe insults her intelligence back and ends up firing her in front of the students. Again, nobody will escape from his wrath. In the beginning, when he talked to the teachers, he basically said it's my way or the highway. So he is demonstrating that he means it. So this is what he feels like he has to do. That teacher was being a little rude, and so she maybe needed to go. So I don't really disagree with that particular instance. Now, back in Joe's office, he talks to Mr. Darnell and chastises Mr. Darnell for defying him in front of the students for picking up a piece of paper during the school song situation. They argue back and forth, and Mr. Darnell offers to kick Joe's black ass. So Joe ends up suspending Mr. Darnell, who swiftly tips Joe's desk over. Now, I didn't mention this earlier, but Mr. Darnell was the football coach, and he got demoted to the assistant football coach because Joe was tired of the football team sucking. So they already have this history of Mr. Darnell not feeling valued by Joe, and things just kind of got a little heated in this moment. Right after that, Miss Levias, who is the vice principal, comes into the room after she hears all of the ruckus. And when Joe was like, well, I suspended, you know, Mr. Darnell. And she's like, Joe, you can't suspend teachers. And he's like, well, I can recommend it. Give me the paperwork. But Miss Levias says, like, Joe, nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody knows what you're up to. Nobody knows what's going on. And Joe was like, exactly, that's the way I like it. So he doesn't like for people to know what's going on in his mind. I guess he likes to keep people on their toes and guessing. It's an interesting way to live. So next up, we get a mini montage as the students take the practice basic skills test. Now, in the background, we hear a song by Stetasonic, I think they're called, called like I Ain't Making It, which is a song about hating school. But anyways, like, we see one of the girls answer a question. It's a very simple question, and she gets it wrong, and it's like, these students need a lot of work. Okay, now Joe sees Sam's in the hallway and even jokes with him a little bit. So again, he's still building credibility with the students, and it's going well for the most part, right? So Richard, the school or the class president, is presenting a model of Passaic River Falls to some adults in the area. Now things are starting to make sense. So what it looks like is that the students built a model of a river, and it appeared to have running water and lights and things on it. And the press was there to kind of show that, like, hey, the school is doing better. We're doing projects. We're doing good or whatever. And so, like I said, like a few press members were there. So suddenly, out of nowhere, some young girls come up to Joe in the cafeteria saying that there's some guy beating up Kid Ray. And Kid Ray is like the slick, possibly white kid who wears suits in school. The guy who's beating up Kid Ray is the drug dealer that was threatening Joe from earlier in the movie, and he somehow managed to get back into the school. When Joe comes into the room, the drug dealer pulls out a knife on Joe, and Joe ends up knocking him down with a punch. A photographer is there, and the reason why I was like, oh, this makes sense, the photographer was already there to do the story on them creating that model. And so I guess when the photographer heard that there was a fight going on in the school, he decided to go to the cafeteria to capture the real story, I guess. And so that's where the photographer came from. It took me a minute to put two and two together. So there were some compromising pictures. During this time when Mr. Wright, the security officer, is holding back this drug dealer, Joe is trying to figure out how he got in the school. And the security officer is like, you know, one of the kids must have let him in, or somebody must have let him in from the inside. And so Joe decides that every door in the school has to be chained and locked to keep the riffraff from seeping back into the school. So this is my first major issue with Joe's decision. Joe embarrasses kids in front of other people, and I'm not really down with that. Like, I don't think that's appropriate today, but I understand that making an example out of someone was all the rage back then. So I don't fault him too much for that. But this, however, the trapping of students inside a building that could have an emergency, a fire, a riot, it, you know, a number of things can happen at a school, and children not being able to escape in a timely fashion is a big risk. And the fire marshal would be all over him. Now, later on, outside of the like principal's office, Joe spots Kenesha, who looks like down and, you know, distraught. Joe asks her what's wrong, and she says that her grades aren't good and she doesn't have a place to live because her mother doesn't want her anymore. So Joe instructs Miss Levias to try and help with the situation. So Joe and Miss Levias take Kenesha home to have a chat with her mom. This appears to be Halloween night. So by now, Joe has probably only been at the school for less than a month. So during the chat with Kenesha's mom, we see their apartment. It's a little bit run down, but it's clean. It's not too bad. It might be like a studio-ish apartment. It doesn't appear to really have any bedrooms. But Kenesha's mom was a teen mom who had Kenesha when she was 15. And now that Kenesha is getting older, she basically released Kenesha into the world because she can take care of herself. And she also mentioned so she could have a life, right? Like, she was 15 when she had a baby and she's worked her behind off to take care of her. And now that she has an opportunity to grab some of her life back, she wants to take the opportunity. But Kenesha's mom also says that she's getting clean and is experiencing her life and her decisions through a sober lens, and doesn't want Kenesha to see her mom in this state. And it's sad, it's vulnerable, but this actress is acting, y'all. I don't know that I recognize her from anything else, but this actress did a fantastic job right here. Now, Joe offers to help her find a job and a better place to live, and Kenesha's mom seems receptive to the offer, and Kenesha seems relieved. This is like a reach one, teach one situation. We're hyper-focusing on certain students, but it appears that Joe cares about not just the educational environment, but what's going on with kids outside of school, and hoping that they make really good choices. So it's interesting to see how much interest he takes in the students and learning their names and interacting with them. And up until the point that he put the chains and locks on the doors, I don't know that I was in complete disagreement with him. So he must be doing something right. So in this next scene, Joe goes to the city council chambers, where he comes face to face with that vocal mom from earlier, like the little PTA meeting, and even hears a racist joke from Rosenberg. That came out of nowhere. I don't know what that was supposed to be, but it made me hate Rosenberg. But now it's in the newspaper that Joe fought a former student, and that that vocal mom, whose name is Mrs. Barrett, is leading the charge in the fight to get Joe ousted. Now, Joe talks to Frank Napier, who, again, is his friend from teaching from a long time ago and is now the superintendent of schools. And Frank is tired of coming under the line of fire for Joe. Joe has issues with the parents. He said that they should get off welfare. He has issues with the teachers, who is firing and suspending left and right and embarrassing in front of the students, and they are threatening to walk out. We also got him going up against the fire chief, who says it's illegal to put chains on the door. So Joe is like causing a bunch of problems. Joe flips the switch on Frank and says, "You know what? I'm disappointed in you, brother." And Napier And he's like, oh, Napier, you know, you knew, you've known me for 30 years. You knew what I came here to do. You recruited me for the job. Now, Napier says, N-word, can you be quiet and stop alienating everyone? We find out that even Joe's wife left him and that he really has no life outside of this school. Napier says that Joe is making a bunch of mistakes. He suspended Mr. Darnell. He fired Miss Elliott, the choir teacher, and her ego. And their back and forth is quite interesting. You can tell that they're friends, that they know each other, but their relationship is a little bit different because Napier is Joe's boss. And so Joe brings up racism as the main issue, but Napier says, Joe, you need to focus on getting those test scores up. You need to issue an apology to the teachers and the women of this community, and you need to kowtow. I haven't heard that term in a long time, but basically Joe needs to learn how to do the politics and play the game and stop being such a tyrant that he gets on everybody's like bad side. So Napier puts his foot down and basically says, contrary to popular opinion, I am the HNIC, which is hilarious. Joe shuts up, which is miraculous because nobody ever shuts Joe up. And then Napier says, come on, let's get something to eat, which is hilarious. That's a classic, like, yeah, we just got into an argument, but yeah, let's come on and get something to eat. I love the whole idea of like, it's no hard feelings. It's water under the bridge. Now let's enjoy a meal together. And I see that a lot in relationships too, right? But anyways, the next day, the press and the fire chief want to get into the school, and Mr. Darnell is outside there, outside the front of the school, restricting their access. So Joe says that anyone who wants access to the school will have to apply for a pass. Now, Joe is carrying a baseball bat, and when someone asks him what it's for, he says the famous line in one of my favorite quotes from the movie, they used to call me Crazy Joe, now they can call me Batman. That is so funny, y'all. Batman? That's hilarious. Now, the fire chief ends up leaving, and Joe even admits to Mr. Darnell that he shouldn't have fired him and that it's good to have him back. So Joe ate a little bit of crow, y'all. Now, Miss Levias, as Joe is walking through the school, challenges him on some of the things he's doing. She's like, you're antagonizing the fire chief. You holding a bat is probably not a good image for the school. And Joe kind of disregards her. And Joe is like, the only thing I want from you is to get those test scores. Where are the test scores? He pretty much disregards her, even though she is his second in command as the vice principal of the school. So, I can see how she would be particularly frustrated by Joe. Now, Joe sees Kid Ray in the hallway and asks why Kid Ray got beat up by that drug dealer. Now, Kid Ray does not really answer the question and says that he only came to school that day to say goodbye and basically that he's dropping out of school. Joe tells him, you'll be dead in a year. And Kid Ray looks so sad as he's leaving, but it feels like he's experiencing despair and like he feels like he doesn't really have a choice. We hear an instrumental version of Lean On Me playing in the background. Now, I hadn't heard it up to this point. They could have played it earlier and I missed it, but the song isn't really that integrated into the story, even though that's the name of the movie, right? So there's the Lean On Me connection. Now in the hallway, Sam's is with some friends, the same friends that he was with earlier when they had to sing the school song in the cafeteria. But he ends up getting caught alone in the hallway when his boys go into the bathroom. Joe catches them skipping class and goes into the boys' room and demands that these repeat offenders sing the school song or they're going to be suspended for like 10 days. In this shocking thing, Joe seems very shocked by this. The boys sing the song, they know all of the words, and they change the melody. It's very Boys to Men-ish, barbershop quartet-ish a little bit. There's one guy leading the song, and the other boys are just harmonizing in the background. The song is very different than the version that we heard earlier in the movie. So it's not the same school song that Joe came to know and love and wanted everybody to remember. We all know it. Nana, yeah. The is so funny to me. It's hilarious. Sometimes I'm just chilling with my husband and I'm just like, yeah. He will attest to that. That's actually very true. It's just so funny. But anyways, the boys know the song. And Joe interrupts them and demands to know who taught them this version of the song. Sam reveals that it is Mrs. Powers, who is teaching choir at this time. So she's trying to instruct the choir, and Joe comes into the class and he's huffing and puffing and he's yelling about not authorizing her to change the song. And she's like, well, the kids thought it was boring, so I switched it up, I remixed it. And he's yelling at her in front of the kids, but then he flips the switch again and gives her credit for rewriting the alma mater. And the kids are happy. They're happy for her for getting some credit, because Joe does not always give credit. And they're probably also happy that their school alma mater will have like a little soul in it. Okay. It's the classic fake out in the movie, right? When you think a person is mad at you, but they're delighted. I don't know why we get a kick out of that. It's feels emotionally dishonest, and like, don't fake me out like that, just personally. Now, by this time, the school is in a much better condition. Like, there's no graffiti on the walls. They have some murals that have been painted. It appears clean and brighter than it was before at the beginning of the movie. We are seeing the like physical space being transformed, right? Now, Joe is so happy about this school song thing that he is walking through the halls of the school saying hi to people he normally doesn't say hi to. He's giving high fives. He's just in a really good mood. So he's still coming off this high about being excited by the song when Miss Levias and Mr. O'Malley show him that the scores from the practice test came in. Unfortunately, only 33% of the student body passed when they needed 75%. Which, if I remember correctly, is actually them backsliding, because the previous year they had 38% pass. So that's awful. Joe returns to his angry self, and he's mad that he waited so long to get such bad news, which he blames on Miss Levias, who he asked multiple times to get those results. Now, in the gym, the teachers gather, and Joe splits the teachers into 30-70, like, and demands that they start to build programs that will help students raise their scores, right? And he's like, we need remedial reading classes on Saturdays, we need a peer mentoring program, and one of the teachers is like, how do we get the kids here on Saturdays? And I'm like, girl, that's the biggest problem, because I don't want to go to school on Saturdays, okay? But Joe says we need to get everybody involved, right? Like, if we need to go to people's houses and recruit them, again, an each one teach one kind of situation. We need to, if the parents can't read, we let them come to the remedial classes as well. We get everybody involved. We make sure these kids are studying. We get them ready for this exam. And he does another version of his speech about like accountability for the teachers, right? Like, he gets the 70% of the students, 70% of the teachers who are gathered in the gym to raise their hands up high to demonstrate how they are failing this large amount of students, right? Like, 67% of the students did not pass this test. They don't have basic skills. And so he's calling them to the carpet for not caring more, for not being better prepared for the students, for not making sure that students who needed additional help got it. And so he makes them stand with their hands raised to show the kind of despair of the children who are failing, and to say, like, these kids will be in the same posture and staring down the barrel of a gun from a police officer if we don't help them. So it's another rousing speech. It's another demonstration of how serious the stakes are for the students. Now, we get a real life montage, actually longer montage, where we see the kids all buckling down to do better and prep for this test. There's like lots of visual reminders. There's t-shirts being made. There's banners. There's a big banner that has like this countdown of the amount of days left until the test. And the students are getting into it, right? The kids are coming in on Saturdays to do reading. There are kids studying so hard that they actually set places on fire from not paying attention and having their nose in a book. Kanisha is spending time with her mom. And Kanisha is also paired with a tutor who is Richard, the school president. And there's just like this energy and this little campaign for everyone to get prepared and get ready to get their butts in gear to pass this test. And things feel pretty hopeful. So that's nice. In the gym, the kids are having PE, and one of the class clowns, whose name I don't know but actually appears quite a bit in this movie, is doing an imitation of Joe Clark, and the other kids are laughing at him. And so Joe ends up catching him doing this imitation and pretends to send the kid to the principal's office, but says that he is just joking. Joe even asks one of the girls if this boy has enough juice to be Mr. Clark, which is hilarious. Joe even jumps rope with the kid, so it's nice to see the bonds that he is building with these students, even though he is facing a lot of opposition from the adults. The kids have pretty much taken to him, at least the ones that are still around and weren't expelled. Now, in the mayor's office, Mrs. Barrett, the vocal, you know, parent that was in that first PTA meeting, and a few other parents are complaining. The fire chief talks about the liability that they would incur if a student got hurt due to the chains on the doors. Napier and Rosenberg are both taking up for Joe, which is interesting because Rosenberg made that little racist joke earlier. The fire chief calls the kids or the people in that community savages, which ill racism again. And the mayor is just, you know, being battered with the cacophony of voices. So he asks to be alone with Mrs. Barrett. And once everyone else leaves the room, Mrs. Barrett wants Clark's head on a platter and says that Joe is a guard dog to keep the black folks in line. And Barrett is like, I don't really like none of y'all. But she says that she will mobilize the community against the mayor so that he doesn't get reelected. And she's like, I already have enough influence in the community to make it real hard for you to win this seat again. She also says that she wants a seat on like the education board so that she can oust Joe for good. So the mayor folds a little bit and says that he's going to sick the fire chief on Joe. And she's like, yeah, let's do it. And then we can get Joe out for good. And so in the bathroom, the men's bathroom, the fire chief and the mayor decide that they're going to nail Joe in a week. It'll give the kids some more time to prep for the test that's coming up, as well as satiate Miss Barrett, which will in turn have the mayor be reelected again. Right. So there's the politics for you. We think the mayor is a decent guy. And of course he is. And he's a politician. Right. So Rosenberg just so happens to be sitting on the toilet and overhears this plan. So now we are 6 days out from the test, and Napier and Rosenberg go to the school and warn Joe about the fire chief coming and their plan. So Joe, while he's with Napier and Rosenberg, makes some white students sing the new alma mater, and they do it poorly, and it's pretty funny. But he walks with the men through the school, and again, he has great bonds with the students, knows their names, and we see that some of the Hispanic students have gathered to complain that they feel ignored by the types of activities that are at the school and that they cater mostly to the black students. So Joe was like, go in my office, I'll talk to you later. Also in the office, there's a bunch of students who have something that they need. And Joe is juggling a bunch of balls, right? Including the threat of the fire chief. None of the balls appear to have fallen yet, but it feels like it's going to get there. And Joe is probably like a few bad things happening from being overwhelmed is what it kind of seems like. Now, he goes into a meeting with the teachers and the security saying that the fire chief is coming. We have a plan to outsmart the fire chief. And he basically says we're going to use code 10 to notify everyone in the building that the fire chief is nearby so that the locks can be removed from the doors so that they won't be caught with the locks actually on the doors. So everyone is in agreement with that plan. And when Miss Levias tries to talk to Joe after the meeting is over, he yells at her because he's overloaded and overworked and she can't seem to like do anything without him. And he yells at her in front of the other teachers. Again, this is a vice principal, like his second in command. And again, a lot of the things in the movie I feel kind of okay with, but this is one of the things that I don't like about his leadership style, because he comes into the building saying that he's the HNIC. He punishes people severely for stepping out of line, including firing people. He creates an environment where he has to make all of the decisions, and he gets mad when all of the work is on him when he really didn't empower the people who were under him. So he has this very authoritative role. He doesn't know how to do collective leadership and is more so like demanding people around instead of being appreciative of them being on board and working together to accomplish this major feat. And that night, Miss Levias catches Joe before he leaves the school and she asks to be transferred. Miss Levias is yelling and she's like, you're going to stand here and you're going to talk to me. And she calls him an egomaniacal windbag. And she says, you think you're doing this all alone, but you got 300 teachers here on staff that have put up with your abuse because we care about these kids and we're doing our parts. And she's like, you're just barking orders. We're the people on the front lines that are actually teaching and educating these kids. And these kids aren't ready for this test. You're too busy worried about your ego and yourself to realize that. And she's like, you don't show appreciation for us. You don't tell us we're doing a good job. She calls him thoughtless and cruel. And she's like, the teachers are sick of it. And so am I. And so she tells him off and Joe really can't say nothing. So that's that. So it's the day of the real basic skills test. So this would make it, I believe it's April 13th. And the students are there in the assembly hall. They're doing an assembly before the test starts. And as Joe heads to the stage, it is silent AF. And so this is a full circle moment when we go back to the part of the movie where Joe first did the assembly and how rowdy it was, how dangerous it was, and how he had to expel students to get rid of most of that riffraff. But we see this complete 180, right, of like how it was before versus how it is now. As he's walking up to the stage, he hands Miss Levias her transfer letter that she requested. He gets on the stage and he starts telling the students what the world is saying about them, right? That they are worthless and poor and a waste and that they can't learn. He even asks the white kids to stand up to show that they are all the same, right? These white kids, if they could do better and be somewhere else, they would have left us a long time ago, but they're here with the rest of us. So we are all the same. We are all in community. It's not, you know, these white kids are not better because they are white. They are here with you in the trenches as well. So we are all in community. We rise and fall together. We're all in this together. Joe is grateful to Miss Levias for reminding him of the fact that they are in community and that they are doing this together. And so he kind of gives her credit for that without saying her name as he's, you know, doing his pep talk. He tells the students that they are not inferior, that their grades may be inferior and their school used to be inferior, but they are going to take this test and make liars out of the naysayers. Okay, the test is in an hour. And he's like, Eastside High is a spirit that will not die. And it goes back to what he was saying earlier about these students being a ghost, right? Of like resurrecting the spirit of Eastside High and kind of restoring it to its, you know, former glory. So again, we get this full circle moment. Now, right after he's done with his speech, Mrs. Powers, the one who remixed the school song, sings Lean On Me in the assembly and all the kids join in with her. There's a lot of energy in the room. It's kind of like a pep rally with the kids all singing, Lean On Me when you're not strong and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lead on. So yeah, they all sing the song together. It's great. It's a sweet song. It's a wonderful moment. And it's a very interesting way to get hyped up before a test. Like, I low-key think I might be into that. hyping myself up before having to do something that's probably really stressful for me. During the song, Miss Levias actually balls up her transfer letter and it looks like she's planning on sticking around, y'all. All right, so in this next scene, Miss Barrett is causing some ruckus down to the fire chief's office because they haven't provided her with what she needs to get Joe out of that position, which is evidence of chains on the doors. If she can prove that the man is breaking the law, then she has what she needs to get the board to oust him. Now, the mayor and her get into like a little bit of an argument. They're in a pissing match. You don't want to get me angry. Well, you don't want to get me angry. I don't make idle threats, X, Y, and Z. But the mayor decides that the fire chief needs a court order to go into the school now, because up until this point, Joe has been able to keep the fire chief out because he, I guess, had no lawful right to be on the premises. But with a court order, it's kind of nothing that they can do. So the mayor is yielding and bending because the influential Miss Barrett actually has quite a bit of a pull or juice in the community and he wants to get reelected, right? So, yeah, back at the school in the auditorium, Kenesha and her friend Lillian are skipping class. The test is over. I don't know how much time has passed since they took the test. I have no idea. It's probably a week or two later. Who knows? But Kenesha and her friend Lillian are skipping class and Kenesha's in the auditorium crying. Joe comes in to yell at the kids for skipping class, but we find out that Kenesha got pregnant and she asks Joe not to be mad at her. Kenesha says that she can't tell her mom and the father of her child, Richard, denies that the baby is even his and she's upset because, you know, she'd never been with any other boy and rightfully so, right? Her mom said that she was 15 when she had Kenesha and Kenesha is probably probably around the same age. So it's a little bit of a generational curse. And it's interesting that they included that in this movie. Just because I guess a school is turned around in terms of education doesn't mean that we have completely gotten rid of the generational curses and things that plague this community, a poverty-stricken community, a community that doesn't have a lot of resources. So I'm sure this is the real life story of somebody, but it's quite interesting that they had Kenesha, this very promising, like really empathetic girl, is now pregnant by the class president, Richard. Yeah, it's an interesting way to kind of close out Kenesha's storyline. But Joe comforts her, saying that she was doing so well. And he even says that there are alternatives. And I'm like, Joe, what are you talking about? But he says that Kenesha's mom should come to the school. They're going to put their heads together and figure something out. But just then, Candyman, the head of security, runs in saying that the fire chief got past the gate. So they are on the radios. They call out a code 10 and they yell about taking the chains off the doors. And unfortunately, the fire chief is there and catches that on audio. So Joe is arrested, and a TV camera is there with them and the fire chief. So all of this is captured, and I guess it's supposedly going to be on the news later on. Miss Barrett is also there, and she says, I'm going to take this tape to the school board. There's a meeting that night, and they're going to vote Joe's black ass out. It's very interesting that a black woman is leading the charge to get Joe kicked off the school board. She comes across to me as being very power hungry, and the inner city version of a Karen in the suburbs. Very Karen-ish. Yes. So unfortunately, Joe, like I said, gets arrested, and they literally have to like parade him through the school to get him down outstairs to the police car. So some of the students are there, and Sam's calls Barrett a B-word, and now Levias is acting principal while Joe is in jail, and like the kids are seeing this black man that they admire get arrested, right? And when the students ask about what's happening, he's like, oh, you know, you break the law, you pay the price. And so he's kind of taking it on the chin to be a good example for the students. And all of the students are pretty sad, but Kenesha is especially sad, right? Because they just had like a really touching conversation, and she sees a male figure that she admires in her life being carted away to jail. Triggering, possibly. So at the jail, Frank and Rosenberg provide their support, and they have to leave to go to the school board meeting, which is in the same building as the jail. It's very interesting. So Frank says that he has no complaints about what Joe has been able to do at the school, that it was basically a miracle. And Joe isn't happy to be in jail, but he thinks that he knows, you know, what's up. Like he, you know, I've been trying to tell my students not to go to jail and look at me here, but I think he knows he did what he thought was the right thing to do. Now, down at the board meeting, Miss Barrett is leading the charge against Joe, saying that, you know, those practice scores were like 35% short of passing. He's failing our children. And I'm like, girl, that practice test was like 2 weeks after the man got there. Like, what was he supposed to do? Give them knowledge by osmosis? Give a man some time. The whole room breaks out into a cacophony. Again, it seems like everyone is kind of divided on where they stand on Joe Clark, which is pretty much the essence of who he is in this movie. Outside of his jail cell, Joe can hear loud voices saying, "Free Mr. Clark." It's his students protesting. And at the board meeting, a cop comes in to notify Rosenberg and the mayor that this crowd is gathering outside in support of Clark. So the mayor goes to talk to Joe inside the jail cell, and he's like, "Joe, you have to send the kids home." And Joe was like, "I don't have to do nothing but stay black and die." Hilarious. Love that quote. One of my favorite quotes from the movie. Now, Miss Barrett has a megaphone, and she's trying to talk to the mom, but they aren't listening. They're just yelling "Free Mr. Clark" over and over again. And the mayor says that, you know, in the jail cell, he's like, "Joe, I wanted you to succeed." And it's like, no, you didn't. And he's like, "You need to think about the kids and their safety, because if things get too out of hand, you know, some of these kids might get hurt." So yeah, Joe's hands are tied a little bit. One of the students, the one whose name I don't know, but actually pops up a lot in this movie, takes the megaphone and says that they should listen to this old loudmouth wench. And so as she starts to say her piece, the kids defend Mr. Clark, and they talk about what he means to the school, what he means to them. And then Richard pipes up to say, like, what you all don't understand is that Mr. Clark believes in us. He has a really weird voice. It's that he believes in us. But then Kanisha shuts him down, saying, he doesn't believe in you because you don't take care of your responsibilities. It's hilarious. That's also a pretty fairly quoted phrase in this story or in this movie. But it's like they're supposed to be there for Mr. Clark, and Kanisha could not resist playing out some of her teen drama. It's very funny to me. Kanisha says that Joe is like a father figure. And by this time, Joe is out of his prison cell and is kind of like behind Miss Barrett and not visible. And so he's listening to what the students have to say about him and all of the warm things that they feel towards this educator who has turned things around for them and given them hope. And so at some point, Sam's says, we don't want a good principal. We want Mr. Clark, which is hilarious. It's still funny, right? Mr. Clark, who again has been listening in the wings, comes to take the megaphone from Mrs. Barrett. He makes a joke and then tells the kids to go home. You need to have respect for the law. Your voices have already been heard. And right then, a van load of cops is coming out to, you know, do crowd control. So it's getting to the point where if things boil over too much, people might actually get hurt. The kids aren't trying to hear it. They're like, free Mr. Clark. They're like, we ain't going nowhere. Miss Levias comes up to Joe with a letter, and he berates her a little bit about it, but she's like, if you don't get this, look at this letter, okay? He opens the letter, and it reveals that the students passed the basic skills test. The crowd rejoices. Everyone's super happy. The impossible has been achieved, right? And so Joe, you know, brings up the mayor with him, and he says, you know, on behalf of me and all the students at Eastside High, you can tell the state to go to hell. And so the mayor and Mrs. Barrett retreat. They really can't say anything too bad about him because he got them the results that they wanted. And they are long gone from the story now. And the underdog won, y'all. And they sing the school song. It's this lovely moment where, you know, the bad people are gone. Everybody is happy. The underdog wins. And the movie ends with some kids graduating while the credits roll. Now, the graduation robes are pink and blue and very gendered, which I have never seen before at a high school. Do they gender graduation robes? Usually they are like school colors. Like, oh, you know what? Maybe not. When I say gendered, I mean pink for the girls and blue for the boys. But I mean, like, if you go to a school and the colors are purple and gold, they may ask the boys to wear purple and the ladies to wear gold. So maybe they do gender graduation robes. I never really thought about it before. But anyways, a soulful rendition of Lean On Me plays in the background. And then immediately after, while the credits are still rolling, there's another rap song by Big Daddy Kane called Rap Summary, Lean On Me. And it samples the song Lean On Me. And it's like, dang, how many versions of Lean On Me y'all got in this movie? Well, that is all for Lean On Me, y'all. At the end of every review, we ask the same two questions. Is it worth a rewatch, and does it hold up today? Yes, it's worth a rewatch for me. It's still a soul-stirring underdog tale that's wonderfully acted. It's very raw and real. It's full of victory and challenges and like real people. And you can tell that these are like real rough around the edges people. It even has some hilarity that makes it a classic. But when it comes to this movie holding up, I'm going to say mostly. And that's only because Joe's methods don't really align with the modern day sentiments of child rearing and education. His management style is probably the most egregious part, like the way that he interacts with the teachers. I can understand him being authoritative and forceful with the students. But the way he interacts with the teachers is just pretty awful and is a very like outdated way of dealing with the people you manage. And this is one thing I will say. I worked at a school, a private school for 6th through 12th graders for 3 years. And one of the things that is just very curious to me is that people at schools that go on to be administrators and principals and vice principals are basically always have been teachers themselves. And just because you're a good teacher doesn't mean you're a good manager of people. So I'm curious about how they distinguish between like the leaders who can be administrators and good people managers, as opposed to people who were just like, they were good at their job and a promotion feels right. I don't know. For Joe, maybe the management of people part just wasn't, which is part of his job, just wasn't there for him. But yeah, overall though, I feel like we have this like radical educator just doing what he thinks is best to turn a school around on a short timeline. And in the end, the good guys win, the students win, the community wins. And I really don't have much more to say about it. I thought that I would disagree with more of his methods because I hadn't seen the movie in very long. But in general, I thought he was right on the money with his tactics, excluding, like I said, the treatment of his staff and the locking of the doors, right? But what do y'all think? Was he really crazy Joe, or was he like just misunderstood Joe? Rest in peace to the real Joe Clark, who died in 2020, and God bless all the teachers who look after and educate the young minds of the children, okay? May your pockets be enriched with better pay, all right? Now let's talk about the ratings for this movie. The critics at Rotten Tomatoes gave Lean on Me a 68% and the audience gave it 85%. Now, of course, I am more on board with the audience score, okay? In my life as a Black person, I feel like this movie is quoted and reenacted almost as much as The Color Purple. It's a part of Black canon, y'all, okay? We got to give it that. So I will probably rate this movie closer to like an 89, okay? Like even higher than the audience. So thanks so much for listening to my review of Lean On Me from 1989 here at Sup Media Reviews. Listeners, what are your thoughts on this movie? Does it hold up for you? Did you rewatch it recently? Share your thoughts on our social media pages on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And don't forget to let us know if you liked this experimental format, okay? Join us next time when a special guest helps me review the 2003 film Holes, featuring a young Shia LaBeouf. You don't want to miss it. Peace out. Thanks for listening to Sup Media Reviews. I hope you enjoyed our trip down memory lane just as much as I did. If you have any suggestions for movies or TV shows you'd like me to review next, or if you just want to share your thoughts on today's episode, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest at Sup Media Reviews and on supmediareviews.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps me improve the show and spread the word to new listeners. So until next time, peace out, home slices.